It's time for She Says Art and He Says Science, your weekly hour of edutainment as you learn about the creative interaction between artists and scientists. With your host, Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist and arts enthusiast, and Mark Kiesling, the founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit. Now it's time for She Says Art and He Says Science.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder and CEO of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so that our artists, the scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations.
Hi, everyone. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton. I'm a guest host this week, and when I'm not doing that, I'm an assistant dean for faculty affairs and professional development at Indiana University School of Medicine. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Krista. It's so glad. So glad that we can have you here. Today's conversation is going to be fun. We're going to find a focus on insect songs, which is otherwise known as baffling. And we're going to talk about crickets, music from nature, and insect proteins, which is really fun, as well as culture. And we have two really special guests. Please welcome Robin Cox, who is the Associate Professor of Music Arts and Technology at IUPUI. Hi, Robin.
Glad to be here.
So glad to have you again. And we have Andrea Lysiega, who is also the Associate Professor of Food Science and the Director of the Sensory Evaluation Lab at Purdue. And hopefully we'll find out more about that as well.
Yes. Hi. Good evening, everyone. Nice to be here with you.
Great. So we can almost start anywhere, but I wanted to start really about the thing that got me thinking about this, which was the idea of that crickets make sounds to do things with their mate, to attract them. And they use an instrument of their body that's very similar to what we do with some other instruments that are stringed instruments. So, Robin, why don't we start with you, and how are crickets and making sounds similar to some of the things that you do?
Well, as a violinist, the essential components of creating the sound is the bow, held by the right hand, usually, drawing across a string. Now, what one may not know is the hair of that bow, or the loose part that has to be sort of put at a certain tension, that's actually horse hair from an actual horse. And microscopically, there's little hitches, or I'm sure there's a better scientific term for this, but little hitches microscopically in those hairs, so that thousands of times per second, that string is set into action by the pulling off of from that hitch, so that it creates a very, very, very fast vibration, because the hair feels smooth, but it's actually, particularly because it's from a horse, I don't mean to rhyme here, it's more coarse than from many sources, and that it creates the vibrational pattern of the string, which is then sent through a wood piece that's attached very tightly to the string called the bridge, and then goes into the sounding box. I'll leave it there for the purposes of this moment.
Okay. And Andrea, crickets, what's special about their legs?
Well, I'm not an entomologist, but I would say that, you know, that crickets would make a similar behavior in a sense, right? That they have tiny, I don't know if they're called hairs in insect terms, but they would make that, similar motions or vibrations that would lead to a sound. Do I pass the test?
Yeah. In fact, I wonder, Robin, if on the horse hair on that bow, if there's more to it, if there must be little kinds of very tiny, almost microscopic little hooks or something that causes it to grab?
Right. I guess I used the word hitch, but you're right. Hook. So in other words, it very, very, very quickly and a great multiple of times, it pulls at that string, if even ever so slightly, to set the vibration pattern of the string, tensioned string of the violin into motion.
Wow. Well, what I do know about the crickets is that they have a similar apparatus. They have what's known as do many insects, also some birds do this. They do have kind of a hook and comb system. And so if somebody's a listener at home, you may have thought about playing with a comb when you were littler and moving your fingers across the comb and producing a sound. It's a very similar kind of thing that's happening both in the insect and bird world, which I think is very interesting how they do it. And it's called baffling because they were able to increase the volume by bouncing it off of something. And so you were talking, Robin, about a soundboard. And in a way, you're able to increase the volume, right?
Right. And to back up one step, also, when you talk about the motion of that comb, if you do it slowly enough, you hear these as a sequence of individual events. If you do it very fast, it blurs into sounding to us like a singular event that has a frequency that we hear as a constant, not as individual vibrations or events happening past a certain point. So it's the same as with the violin, not to the sounding box. So the string sends the vibration through what's called a bridge, a hardwood piece that transmits that vibration into the open area, the box of the violin. And the box does two things. One, it shapes the sound quality by increasing some frequency, some what's called overtones of the sound, and decreases others a bit. For the most part, it actually brings up the lower end frequency vibrations of that sound to make a warmer sound than it would have otherwise. And then, so different parts of that vibration in the air are brought forth more readily, while other ones are tamped down. And if you get the shape and the composition of the materials right, as one does with a violin, then it can make for a very pleasing sound that is propagated out well beyond the confines of where that musician's standing. So it both amplifies and shapes the quality of sound together.
One of the things that I think is really interesting to kind of think about sort of both the experiences of musicians and thinking about sort of how crickets work, right? The idea that it's sort of the mix of the movement that in this case, the person or the insect is making and the environment that creates the sound that we perceive, right? It's not one, but it's the interaction of both. So Robin, when you are sort of playing a composition, can you talk a little bit about kind of how you make decisions about what instrument you're using and about the physical space that you're playing in?
Yeah, to some degree, the instrument combinations in a work of music or the intended ones are for how one would understand the interactions of these different. Well, to back up one point, when one makes musical sound, you have a consistent frequency that's called the fundamental. That is, in large part, the science is a little more complicated than this, but in large part, the lowest frequency vibration rate that you're hearing. But for almost any sound we hear, other than what's called the sine tone, you also hear other multiples, mathematical multiples of that frequency that are being set in motion in the air as well. These are called overtones, also could be referred to as harmonics. And that is why a vocalist could sing the same pitch as a violinist, but you know one to be a vocalist or a flute player or a violinist for the fact not of that what's called the fundamental, the lowest sounding ratio in the air, but the proportions of other frequencies above it. How bright, how warm, how rich the sound is. So when you in a composition are making decisions about instruments, you're not just deciding on, you know, is it a low instrument or a high instrument in terms of its relative pitch, but also how will they blend or not blend together. So if you want, say, a string quartet, these are four variations on a very similar a kind of engineered sound. So they're going to blend very readily. That can work for and against you, because if you have melodic ideas traveling along at the same time, you have to be very careful that they're not going to blend into each other too much. Whereas if you, say, have a collection of woodwind instruments, a bassoon and an oboe and a flute, they are so different in their structures that way, in terms of what they excite in this in the air, that they can be hard to meld together. So instrument choice is often based on the musical idea's needs for a multiplicity versus a unity of the whole of the sound the composition is projecting out into the world at that given moment.
That's really interesting, that notion of kind of unity versus multiplicity. And something I think that is, we're talking about insects, and I'm thinking about food sources and like sort of that uniform concept versus the concept versus the multiplicity concept. I bet we'll come back to that.
That's great. Robin, also, was it possible that early instruments were devised sort of to mimic some nature sounds or natural sounds? Do you think that's what people were doing? Or did they just play with, mess with something and got a sound and they liked it?
I'm a little far out on a limb to claim any expertise in this area.
Okay.
There's a long history of musicians evoking the natural world, particularly through bird calls, which can be very musical, a very tuned and pitched set of sequence of notes. So there is that. There is use of. There has been sort of some musicians going way out to the fringe and employing the ideas of insects along the way, or to try to evoke an extra musical sort of narrative proposition to the composition, that you're evoking specifics, not just musical sound, but identifying them with something extra musical. I think that's as far as I can go without, you know, having a musicologist call in and raise some cane.
That's great. And that's probably about where that piece we should have for our listeners is great. I'm thinking back a little bit on what Krista was just talking about, the unity of things and ending up over and thinking about food within that. Andrea, you know, you run the food lab. But one of the big areas that you are doing a lot of research in is insects and insect protein and how that may be able to help. How do crickets fare in the protein area?
Okay. Well, first, let me just first say that, you know, as I was listening to what Robin was explaining on how the sound is generated when, you know, playing an instrument such as a violin and you know, the intricate details that are necessary to create the sound, all I was thinking is like imagining in my brain a cricket, a tiny cricket, you know, less than an inch. And how can that tiny little creature make such beautiful sound? Because I don't know about you, but I find crickets very relaxing when I listen to them, you know, in the summer months when you have your windows open and you're listening to that sound. And for me, it's quite relaxing. I know some people cannot sleep with the sound of crickets, but for me, it's quite relaxing. So I was just thinking about how are they making the sound? And it's so beautiful that I'm just right now my jaw dropped as I was listening to all this explanation. It's amazing. But going into now using that wonderful music and then maybe using them as a protein source, you know, there's over 900 species of crickets. And quite a few of them, if not most of them, are edible, and they're very high in protein, and they are comparable to the protein quality and content that we would find in beef, in poultry, pork, fish. So they're an excellent alternative protein for feeding the world, you know, as population increases and we don't have enough land to grow all the food that we need, especially protein sources. I think thinking about growing farming crickets in the future it's something we really have to start considering more seriously.
And Andrea, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the sort of impetus to think about insects and crickets in specific as a protein source, how that relates to the concept of climate change. I know that that's one of the things that folks are really interested in, is the idea that raising large animals, we know, is a real tax on the natural world. And so can you talk a little bit about some of the environmental impacts of considering insects as a protein source?
Yes, of course. Again, I'm not an expert on that area, but because I do work with proposing insects as an emerging or an alternative protein source, I've had to, learn a little bit more about why they're considered more sustainable compared to our traditional protein sources. Like livestock, for example, and that has to do with the amount of land that would be required to grow. For example, just a rough example, I'm not going to be exact with numbers, I'm just using approximate terms here, but to develop or to create 1 kilogram of beef, of meat from cattle, from livestock, we would need, maybe you need, I don't know, 200 square feet. But, for crickets, you would need 1/10 of that space, because they are grown more like in vertical farms. The amount of water. So, livestock, again, for that 1 kilogram of meat, you would need, let's say, for example, 1,000 gallons of water. With crickets, you need 1/10 of that. The greenhouse emissions that come from livestock, we all know that they're the implications they have on the environment, but crickets produce about 100 times less greenhouse gases compared to traditional livestock. So in a nutshell, definitely I would say crickets and poultry are two of the most sustainable protein sources deriving from animals.
That's really helpful to think about. I think, again, in the context of thinking about the natural world, right? I love as Robin was talking about, the idea of sort of unity versus multiplicity. As humans, we know we need diverse food sources to be healthy, and thinking about what those diverse food sources might look like in relationship to the natural world, I think your example there really illustrates the extent to which it becomes a pretty compelling argument.
Yes. And it's, I mean, like we were saying, it's a hard sell, because we think crickets, and again, we're just thinking of the critters that are making the sound that will maybe don't let me sleep at night. But I think if we go beyond that barrier, mental barrier that we have that's blocking us to explore our palate and open up our senses to actually try different foods, and in considering the fact that insects are widely consumed in many countries across the world, there is almost a 2 million or more, I would say 2 billion people in that already eat insects as their normal diet. So why not in Western countries? That's the question.
Can you say a little bit more about the idea of exploring your palate and how that might sort of shape? Because there, you're right, I agree, there's completely an attitudinal factor here that that we need to get past. So what does that look like kind of day to day if a person is sort of trying to think about eating in a new or different way?
Yes, well, I think there's the term of neophobia. So a lot of people in Western countries are more neophobic. So we're more afraid of trying new foods, but that is changing slowly. And actually, newer generations are starting to be more open to trying, more foods from different cultures, different, international cuisine. And in that, if we start sticking into that concept, insects that are widely eaten in many other parts of the world, I think slowly we're starting to open it up, exploring new flavors and new textures and aromas and dishes that are made with these particular foods. So with insects, I think the problem is that, they're crispy and the way they traditionally will sell them, if you see the all dried up crickets in a basket, then it makes it not very maybe appealing to see. It's like if you were walking through a market and you see all the carcasses, like poultry carcasses, piled up. Well, you don't want to eat that. You want to eat, a nice chicken breast or a chicken leg, served with a nice salad next to it, but not just the carcass of the chicken in front of you. So I think with insects or crickets in this case, we would have to move on into developing actually foods that are more familiar, or that is not just eating the whole insect. So using the protein in the insects to develop food products with different flavors and aromas and mouthfeels.
That makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's great. We have been talking with Robin Cox and Andrea Lysiega about all kinds of things about crickets and food and protein. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about culture. So we'll talk about that a little bit after the break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation about some really fun stuff with crickets and music and all those. We kind of were ending our first segment a little bit talking about culture, or I kind of got a sense we were going there. And I'm really fascinated about how culture defines what is okay for our sense of music and how we are, what we can allow ourselves to be able to say we like or don't like. And it seems that there's great parallels in culture when we talk about food as to what's acceptable and not. So would one of you like to grab that first?
You know, we think more directly about food as about sensory stimulations, but you know, music is nothing if not that, just by a different sense, and pretty much singularly, you know, about, you know, how we hear things. But we can't, we, you know, musicians and composers have been clever over the years at times about evoking, memories and evoking extra musical items, you know, beyond the sense of hearing. It's possible to do that in a non-narrative, non-verbal way. And so musicians are aware of that capacity for musical sound.
Wow.
That's
Andrea?
Yeah, well, you know, the same, sensory wise in terms of, you know, being working in the sensory lab at Purdue University, one of the things we consider is that, you know, the sound that a food is making when you're eating it and the implications it has on your acceptance of that food. So, you know, if you think about it, all of us, you know, when we take out a stick of celery from a refrigerator to use it in a salad, or you bite into that celery stick, you expect that crispiness, no, that resistance and that sound of the celery as you're biting into it. But if it's been in the fridge too long, it's a little bit soggy and you don't get that sound. And that at the same time, that texture, you tend to reject that food more because it's not connecting with your brain of saying, okay, this is good quality, this is meeting my standards. Or, you know, or potato chips, you expect that crispiness as you're biting on the potato chips. And if they don't have that sound when you bite into them, then you would associate them with being stale and probably reject the product. So in those terms, I think the sound is definitely an appealing factor for food perception. But that's, for example, so that's the sound that the food is making, but also think about the environmental sound effects as you're eating your food. So that's why sometimes, you know, when we go to restaurants, they have that background music playing, because again, there's studies that show that depending on the music that's playing on the background as you're eating your food, you will enjoy it more. You know, if you're in an Italian restaurant and they're playing some, you know, nice Italian music on the background, and then on top of that you have the decoration that reflects kind of Italian decor, or then it makes you think that the food is more authentic than if you were hearing, you know, I don't know, hip hop or something in an Italian restaurant with while you're eating Italian food. It just, it's not going to feel the same. You're eating and your perception of that food is not going to be the same by the music or the background sound that you're perceiving at that time.
So one of the things that's interesting to me as I was listening to both of you talk is the idea that we have in varying cultures all over the world, what kind of counts as good, right? How we decide sort of what counts as good music or what counts as you know, really good or gourmet food, if you will. So Robin, can you talk first a little bit about kind of what are some of the things when you think of what counts as good or high quality music, what are the things you look for? And then Andrea, maybe I'll ask you to do the same thing kind of from a food perspective, because I think we're talking about preferences, but there are sort of some guardrails to the preferences.
You know, much of the 20th century, as far as intellectuals with music, you know, this was the turf that things were fought upon, was whether you could objectify quality in music. The modernists that came forth in the 1920s and 30s in particular put a premium on the idea that you could, you know, cognitively enlighten people through being of a, you know, using musical parameters a certain way, and that you could really sort of quantitize this stuff. Now, I'm of a generation that, in a sense, has kind of recoiled from that. So if anything, I'm not the right person to ask, because if anything, I and many of my generation kind of ran the other way as an equal and an opposite reaction, feeling that there was too much of this sort of, you know, it's one thing to be too romantic, but it's also one thing to take all the romanticism out of an art form. And so, you know, leaving some of those details to the mystics beyond what we can understand, you know, for many of us is somewhat desirable. So, boy, what was your original question?
Well, I was talking about sort of like a kind of what heuristic or what framework used for what counts as good music. But yeah. The point, I think one of the things that's important that you're making there is that resistance toward kind of highbrow good, I'll maybe call it that, that's probably not the right term, but is also exists in the food world, right? I think of our colleague at IUPUI, Terry Kurtz, who has a really beautiful poem about corn dogs, right? Foods that are widely considered sort of, you know, lowbrow food, but gosh, a good fair corn dog is legit.
Man. Sure, comfort food. And certain music is designed by the creator of that music for certain situations. There's just certain kind of music that I don't want to be trying to comprehend or to take in while I'm driving a car. It was intended for that, you know, that situation in a recital hall where you're giving over 100% of your capacities to focus on that musical sound. Whereas there's other kind of music that if only an enhancement, certainly could be more, but only if only enhancement tends to, you know, extend and accentuate a given circumstance and is perfect for a car. And maybe not something I want to sit in a recital hall, you know, and sit quietly, you know, behaving myself and intently focused on. So situations beyond the music itself really do matter. And sometimes I think we forget that composers were thinking of those circumstances and that musical sound was almost entirely confined to the rarefied circumstances of a concert hall setting or a church or a salon situation. You know, back 100 years ago, so that much of the classical tradition was understood to be listened where you were sitting in a stiff, upright back chair, you know, where and giving over 100% of your, you know, mental efforts to it. These other kinds of music, the underscore music, the enhancements music, that's really been something that's been, you know, possible by modern technologies, and is probably something that needs to be better understood and better explored.
That's so interesting. So Andrea, when you're thinking about the idea of kind of what counts as good food, you talked a little bit about the environment being a part of kind of what pushes you to think about good food. What are some other sort of attributes about the food or sort of emotions that's created with the food that makes it, that makes someone say this is good or this is bad?
Well, I guess first in terms of the sound, or if we went back into the music, you know, if you think about it, when you know, music brings emotions, and the different music will bring different emotions in all of us, no? And that's why some of us may cry when we listen to a beautiful aria in an opera, and the music as it's opening up the, you know, the performance, and we will cry at the end or not. And then, you know, you can go and see another type of show where, you know, the music is fast paced and you're all pumped up and excited. And so that it's again, playing with your emotions. So the same thing would happen with our food. I think, you know, when we're sad or upset, you know, we've been through some stress, we might not necessarily be very hungry, or in some, depending on the person, and in other cases, it makes you even more hungry because of that stress, but you're not enjoying the food at the same level, because when you're stress eating, it's just to get that sensation that you're eating something, but it's not necessarily that you're savoring that food and enjoying and actually, you know, perceiving with all your senses and the emotions that that food is bringing you. There's also food that can bring you back memories, and it's nostalgic. And again, it, you know, eating that food, you're enjoying it, but, and you're also remembering a part of your life in the past where that you encounter a similar food or a similar aroma, in particular aromas, with aromas, because of the perception of aroma in our brain, that where the aroma receptors are located, it's way up in our olfactory tract. That's where that particular region is. And it's actually very close to the portion of the brain where we keep our long-term memory. So that's why there's that, you know, scientists believe that there's a strong association of why sometimes when we smell something, whether it's a food or we come into somebody's house and we get the smell, it might bring a childhood memory. And that's because the aroma recognition, the receptors for aroma are very close connected in the brain to that area where we have the long-term memory.
So yeah, no, absolutely. And what's interesting, that follows along with what we know about in education, that one of the better ways of laying down those memories is to have multiple senses activated, because they create the connections between that. So you're not only, and it is hard for a human to just knock one out, say, I'm only going to list be the taste if there's something bad happening at the time I'm tasting. So where that kind of leads me is, I would assume, and I could be wrong, but you guys can help me understand, that where you may live, how you may grow up, what you hear, what you may eat, may make it different as to what the experience is. And so culturally, it could be completely different, even in the United States, between neighborhoods or places where you've grown up, but certainly on a worldwide scale, as to what's acceptable both in music and what would be acceptable in food tastes.
Yes. Yeah.
First, maybe perhaps complicating that is the opposite side, where we tend to also be enthralled by the exotic too, by things we're not familiar with, to a point perhaps, but certainly that's true for music. And, you know, I would imagine that that's, well, you know, in my own experience, I know that's true foods to a certain degree, but you know, it's almost like the one step removed things are in a special category, such as, say, if you grow up in the Northeast of the United States, but you hear country music, it's only one step removed. So it's not quite exotic. But if it's from something from Africa, well, now there's a certain kind of level of intrigue by that distance. So it almost seems like for me, there's three levels of stages: the familiar, the slightly familiar, but it's not me. And then there's the exotic that somehow can be as intriguing, more intriguing than that music that's one step removed.
Yeah, that's true.
Andrea, do you think that that's true of food as well? That there's like sort of layers of like what folks will, tolerate's not the right word, maybe again, the preference concept, right? So, you know, I'm originally from the Chicago area, moved to Indianapolis. The pizza here is different, but it's still pretty much
pizza.
I knew
we were going to pizza.
Right, you know, I have to go, the Chicagoan has to go to pizza right away. But as, you know, I think that there is something to be said for kind of push, you know, how do you get to push the boundaries? What, you know, how do you get someone to push the boundaries, whether we're talking about music or in your case, Andrea, food?
Yeah, well, you know, I think going back to that term that I used in the previous segment about the neophobics and the neophilic. So we've noticed in the research that we've done, particularly with promoting foods formulated with insect protein, with cricket protein. We did quite a few surveys across people at Purdue University. So we recruited, you know, about 300 people in a survey, and we're asking them different questions about their perceptions for new foods, for environments, for, you know, international food fair, perhaps, you know, willing to eat insects. And we found that actually I would say about 70% of the group that we polled were interested in, and you know, they were intermediate between neophilic and intermediate, so not quite neophobic. So I think it's changing and more, because now we, with social media and all the you know, this access we have with internet to every corner of the world and of the planet, we are actually being exposed more to what's out there. And I think we want to explore more and try new things, which, you know, if you compare it to our grandparents, great grandparents, when where they didn't have this access to information as easily and readily available as we do now, it was more difficult to think. I mean, how many, you know, when the immigration came, you know, from Italy, for example, I'm thinking of my grandparents when they immigrated from Italy to Canada, you know, it was Italian colony that lived in a little part in Toronto, and they had all their Italian fares and the stores and the food and how that influenced the other people that were coming, you know, from Greece, from Portugal, Canadians that, you know, born and lived their entire life in Canada. So it starts creating all this multiculturalism and exposure to new foods in this case, but also cultures in general.
Absolutely. That's a really good point that my grandmother was also an Italian immigrant to Chicago, and she lived on the south side of Chicago, which means that at the holiday season, in addition to eating the Feast of the Seven Fishes, which I learned recently was an American tradition, we also ate pierogi. So, yes. Right? Like, no one, yes, in my family is Polish, but they were delicious. And I think that you're right to say that part of that is about the environment in which you're living, right? That you get those influences. And I think that that's true with music as well, that the more that you have that opportunity to interact with others, you start to appreciate that culture in a different and new way. That's really cool.
I also wonder how early you have to get to people to have that window open still, or the door open. I know from my own experiences of working with 16-year-olds versus 20-year-olds, that I don't know if this is a matter of risk tolerance or natural curiosity levels, but the 16-year-olds seem to be more willing to attach themselves to a wider variety of musics than a 20-year-old, as if something has hardened in those very few years, and that one's sense of one's own taste has been codified by the time you get to college age. I don't have any data to back this up, but at least in my experience, it seems like there's a door that begins shutting somewhere in there, in terms of openness.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I as you were saying that, Robin, I was thinking, you know, when I was a child, and I remember my father used to, like, occasionally, like on Saturdays or Sunday nights, I can remember very well, but I remember occasionally he would, you know, sit us down in the living room and he would dim the lights and he would play, you know, those old LPs, an opera, and he would be telling us, okay, you know, because it was in a foreign language, and, you know, we were not understanding what they were necessarily singing, but the music, and he would just, you know, listen to the sound of this instrument and listen to the voice of the tenor or the soprano and the emotion they're putting. And now they're telling, you know, they're saying this. And, you know, we were very, I don't know, 6 years old, 8 years old, and my sisters and I, and, you know, at that time, you know, we would be intrigued, but at the same time, we're, you know, at one point we're like, okay, we're bored, we want to go and play. But I think that little seed of listen to this. And as I grew up, I learned to appreciate it. And now I love it. So I started doing the same thing with my children and sitting, you know, I bought them, but now DVDs and put them on and then made them watch, you know, La Traviata with Plácido Domingo. And I said, you know, listen to them. This is what's happening and the emotions. And mommy, but I can't understand. I'm like, don't try to read the words, just listen. And you know, obviously me working with insects, you can imagine what I've made them eat. I've had all the bugs you can think of. Because that's another thing, you know, I keep telling them, do not eat with your eyes. Try, and that's the same thing my father used to tell my sisters and I, don't eat with your eyes. Try the food first. I know it looks squeezy, you know, because he would bring insects home when we were young. He would bring grasshoppers or worms and, you know, all these insects that were sold in the local markets in Mexico, where we grew up. And we were like, and he's like, no, you have to try them at least once. I want you to try them. And if you don't like it, I'll respect your decision of not eating them again. So, you know, we would try one or like, well, actually, it's not too bad. Okay, maybe I'll have another one. And, you know, that helped, I think, us overcome that fear of food.
I don't know if this is a really apt parallel or not, but you know, there's the you know, observation of something you might eat as food before actually eating it, the experience, the sensory experience of actually engaging in it literally, as opposed to observing it. Well, I know as a musician, the music I'm closest to and is the most affecting of me is not only the music I did play, like perform, but it's still that music, even listening to it, not actually engaged, you know, in a literal sense with it, but as an observer, listening to it, not just making it. And so I'm that music is by far the music I've accepted the most into who I believe I am, you know. And so I wonder if there's something about observing, you know, a cricket, as opposed to if you don't observe it first, you just eat the dang thing. If there's a different level of acceptance in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a
that you give that you could give over to it more readily. I mean,
you know, that's an interesting idea to explore, because I think over time, particularly with food, but it may also be with other types of things in the arts, but over time, I think that we have moved away from seeing the actual thing. It gets processed into something, and I think that may be true with music. We may move away from the concert. Although some people still want to go to the concert, but I do think sometimes there are listeners, just like there are ears, who are so removed from where that was, that I think about, where I think, Andrea, is one of these really interesting things is, if I really look at some of the things we eat that are not insects, I don't think I would eat them, you know. If I look at it as what it came from, even some plants, they're pretty, you know, disgusting looking. And so it gets processed into something that I can.
Right. I guess that goes back to the carcass example, that, you know, you're seeing the cut of meat. You're not seeing the cow's carcass versus you may be seeing the whole of the cricket.
Yeah, exactly. That's I think, and that's been the biggest challenge for my research in trying to promote entomophagy or the acceptance of insect protein in Western countries is overcoming that whole insect perception versus trying to get that protein and formulate foods that we're more familiar, more comfortable with eating.
That's really wonderful. This is a wonderful conversation. All these conversations are made possible by the generosity of an anonymous donor who supports the Da Vinci Pursuit's mission of creating a museum without walls. And this is one of those examples of a unique conversation. We'll have more of this conversation when we return.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back, everyone. We're having a conversation about insect songs, crickets, music from nature, insect protein, and culture. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, and I'm going to start us off by talking a little bit about the relationship between our subjects and emotion. So one of the things that's interesting to me is that both food and music require a sort of emotional connection. Certainly you can eat food to sustain yourself and music can be in the background, but to really fall in love with the food or to really fall in love with a piece of music, you've got to be in it. You have to be present. Your emotions have to be there. So maybe Robin, if we start with you, could you talk a little bit about how you perceive the role of emotion in sort of trying new things? You were talking about how 16-year-olds are potentially more open than 20-year-olds. Could you talk about how emotion might play into that?
Well, you know, for you know, going back to my point in an earlier segment about the sort of the musical debate of the 20th century was about how much was this to be about just the, sort of cognitive stimulation, not necessarily connected to the idea of, you know, evoking emotion, at least not in a direct sense. And there was, the argument was made that music is valuable, organized musical sound is valuable, and maybe best, most valuable if it's provoking us intellectually to challenge us to understand what we're hearing, and to not so readily give over to just letting it wash over us and causing some sort of emotional response that we don't necessarily even fully understand. I mean, that was sort of a backlash to the 19th century romanticism that that really has, at least within musical circles, never fully been resolved. But it also didn't fully move out of academia either, because outside of academia and the, you know, intellectual elites, you know, emotion still has been very much present within music. And that doesn't mean necessarily highly overtly emotional. I think there's a lot of music that's rather subtle that way, but And I don't want to be try so hard in a scholarly sense to verbalize this that I get beyond what we actually understand. And I think there's a certain just interest in that regard. I remember in grad school listening to a composer whose name I can't quite remember right now, but he was asked about his love of music of Johannes Brahms, which was not music sounding very much like his own at all. But he said, you know, I've looked at Brahms's music down to the moment by moment measures, to the very notes, to the very chords, and I still have no idea what it's about. And then he just kind of let that thought hang in the air, because it was a rather profound thought. If you could be so invested in an art form, and at the end of the day, you don't really know what you're making. I mean, I would think that if you're involved with, you know, the act of making food for people, you understand, if nothing else, there's nutrition there. You are feeding people, and you can sort of, you know, objectively, you know, describe in scientific terms how that process works. And not to negate that we're, you know, there's an emotional connection to music, foods too. But with music, my gosh, if the whole thing is a mystery, you know, how do we even legitimize ourselves? But you know, for time in memoriam, almost every culture, if not everyone, has had musical content. There must be a reason for that. I mean, it's not something that came and went. And it's been present in good times, bad times, in small groups, large groups. I mean, it's just there. So it obviously, there's something about human wiring, and uniquely human wiring, that desires this as part of one's life. But beyond that, I actually think for some of us, particularly as a composer, not just a performer of music, I like the fact that I'm not fully in control of what I'm doing or why I'm doing it. When I write a piece of music, I mean, we're encouraged, particularly in academia, to be able to describe to the nth degree, to get a white paper sitting on some bookshelf somewhere, right? What we're doing and why we're doing it. But there's a real conflict there, I think, with it being an art form in terms of the nonverbal nature of music versus the verbalizing, as we're doing now, obviously, about what's going on. And at a certain point, we have to respect the fact that some of this we just can't get into words. And if we could, we probably would be using the more efficient means of music of text to express whatever it is anyways. So there's my long, convoluted cop-out answer, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think it's a cop-out at all. I mean, I think that a lot of what, you know, I think part of what you're talking about, and Andre, I think that maybe you can speak to this as well, that certainly, as you said, there's the, you know, there's music that has a purpose, there's music that we've created purposes for, and there's also sort of the musicality of life, right? There are songs that we hear in the world, whether it's the song of a cricket, or it's my neighbor's footsteps upstairs, right? That all of them have a little bit of musicality to them. And so thinking about kind of where are the places where we are connecting with the emotions associated with those sounds? And then, you know, to your point that you've made about food, right? That there's the food that sustains us. Mm-hmm. And then there's the food that we seek out that, you know, has that connection that draws us out in some way, or that is sort of uniquely about our sense of who we are. Mm-hmm. So how does that relate to food more specifically, Andrea? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I was thinking, it's like the first thing that thought that came to my mind is comfort food, right? What happens with, what's comfort food? How will you define comfort food, Krista, for example?
That's a great question. As soon as you said that, I thought a couple of weeks ago, I learned how to make macaroni and cheese in my Instant Pot. Like, so not only is it comfort food, it's fast comfort food, which is really wonderful.
And delicious, but, I assume.
And yeah, very good. And also not super nutritionally sound. I'm aware it's a lot of carbs.
But. Depends on how, yeah, the carbs, right? How about you, Mark? Do you have a comfort food that you prefer?
I do, you know, and this is really funny, but I think it comes out of what you guys were saying. The idea that there are kind of a whole thing that wraps around it, an experience. But I remember my mom, you know, made the normal Indiana, I grew up here in Indianapolis. She made the normal Indiana kind of things, meatloaf, you know, mac and cheese, those kinds of things. But what my friend, I went over to her house when I was 12 and her mom made tacos. And obviously they weren't tacos like from Mexico, but you know, they were, the Ortega, that's my thing, you know, still that ground beef with the stuff and in that shell today. So yes, that's my,
that's, you know, your comfort food.
It's really silly because it's there, but it was something that was so special. I remember running home and telling mom, you have to make this.
And your mom was like, what is that?
What is that? We had like one, you know, Tex-Mex restaurant in Indianapolis and one Chinese restaurant, neither of which were of any kind of authentic at all. That was all that was here when I was growing up. And so it is interesting, you know, my parents, that's really, what is that? You know, who's making that? So.
Yeah. And nowadays, you know, today, how many restaurants we have of all these different ethnicities. So again, that shows how we have evolved into a being more accepting of comfort foods and international foods for this matter. But how about you, Robin? Do you have a comfort food?
Oh, by growing up in Texas, country fried steak, fried okra, mashed potatoes, and way too much gravy.
Yes, that sounds delicious. Yeah.
And I'm not even looking for that restaurant in Indianapolis because I can't hope that it's even here.
No, you'll have to go to Texas for that. Yeah. Yeah, for me, I think it's a nice bowl of homemade pasta with the, you know, the ragu sauce and the meatballs and the Italian sausage. And so those are, yeah. And that's, again, you know, so if you think around, I think the common denominator with comfort foods, it's not that they're unhealthy because, you know, they have the protein, they have carbs, you can have all your food groups, but most importantly, they have fat. So I think a common denominator is that comfort food, I think a rule is that qualify as a comfort food, it has to have fat. I cannot see a salad being a comfort food. I don't think I can envision that, but so that's, I think that's an important factor because fat gives us that sense of, you know, we tend to make fat our enemy, and for decades we've tried to eliminate fat in our diet, right? Like the fat-free food and low-fat this and da da da. And when you eat a food that is traditionally made with rich in fat as it should be, you get that sense of satiety, but it also allows all the aromas and flavors of that food that are present in that food, all those components that make up that food, to actually blend well with your palate and make those connections with your sensory receptors for the aroma, for the aromatics. And that's why the food has just this mouthfeel and beautiful taste, flavor, and aroma, because it's rich in fat. Then when you start taking the fat out, the food starts losing all that, the mouthfeel, the aromas, the aromatics. You don't get that sense of satiety, so you tend to eat more. And now that I've started a keto diet, I was told that no carbs, but eat a lot of fat. I'm like, you're that's great. And it's true because fat fills you up, but it also gives you the comfort, and it gives you the satiety, most important. But also you actually savor that food because it's rich. It's rich in flavors and aromas, and that makes a big difference.
Well, and some of the things that you're talking about there are about that relationship to emotion, right? So the smell, you know, you were talking early about the relationship between smell and memory. And I think that, you know, you're right to say that the less fat that's in that food, that less, you know, you're not going to have that aroma that's there. And so again, kind of going back to that piece about, we seek out not just the nutrition of eating, but the emotional connection to the food, the comfort food.
Like if you're feeling sad, or you know you've had a rough day, and you they offer you a nice slice of you know hot fudge chocolate cake, or a salad, you're gonna go for the cake, right? I mean, if I eat the salad, it's out of guilt, not because it's gonna be more comfortable.
You know, I'm wondering, Robin. You know, this is an interesting conversation. Are there people? Would you say that people have comfort music?
Well, I'm sitting here deciding, am I just trying too hard for the purpose of this conversation, or do I have a thought here? And that is, I wonder if comfort foods also have sort of an immediacy of response, like you get the endorphin release or whatever else quite quickly, like one bite and you're sated to some degree. So, you know, okay, so I'm in a music technology program, right? So I'll loop it into that. In many ways, a lot of the modern technologies of recording technology give you sort of a satisfying blend to the sound and an immediacy. And through things such as compression, you get sort of an evenness of volume that in some ways you get an impression of the music in large part very quickly. It doesn't have a long unfolding, that almost immediately the music is at its max volume. And that you've got all the instruments going and you've got sort of everything in play. And I wonder if there's sort of an equivalency to a lot of circumstances, particularly if you're not giving over in full. Like, at a restaurant where you're getting a multi-course meal, I guess, and you decide you're going to spend your evening there and you're paying good money, then perhaps you're given over to a lengthy process. Well, with music, a lot of times we're using music in circumstances where we're not giving over in full and we're not giving over for lengthy periods of time. So the kind of immediacy of music making where everything's presented to you of the music or most happens very quickly and there's not as much long-term structure such as in the classical tradition. Perhaps there's an equivalency there. Perhaps there's a master's thesis there. I don't know.
So this has been a really wonderful time having a conversation with you. Krista, I appreciate so much that you were able to be here with us as well. Andrea, always a wonderful conversation about insects and protein. And Robin, I love the breadth of knowledge that you have about music. It's really great. Krista, where can they find more information?
Yeah, absolutely. So you'll find pictures of our guest projects and other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website, which is the davincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations. Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
This has been a delightful conversation. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, and I'm reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science. Thanks again to all of you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Good night.
And thank you as well.
Thank you for listening to She Says Art and He Says Science. You can listen to the full show podcast on WICRonline.org, as well as on the DaVinciPursuit.com. Or you can join your hosts, Jill Dittmeyer and Mark Kiesling, here every Saturday at 1 p.m. on a different kind of public radio, 88.7 WICR.